Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Back at the end of July, something terrible happened at a prison camp where Russian security forces had taken thousands of Ukrainian prisoners of war. Dozens and dozens of prisoners were killed, 53 that we've been told about, and maybe more. It didn't take long for the news to come out, and then the Russian authorities started to talk about what had happened in ways, I think it's fair to say, had become normal for them, and tried to pass the whole thing off as a regular, horrible accident of war. They put out a half-hearted explanation, without seeming to worry if it really added up or not. They shipped in a clapped-out American actor, someone who hangs out with Vladimir Putin now and then, apparently, and he made a little propaganda film with his analysis of events.
I mean, we are in the exact place where HIMARS came in. One of the Nazis that was killed is a Nazi that was just starting to talk a lot about Zelensky. I wonder if that's why this guy got rocketed and killed.
Steven Seagal, ladies and gentlemen. Russia blamed the Ukrainians for everything. It felt deliberately routine. The message was, nothing to see here, nothing out of the ordinary. It didn't work, of course, in most of the world anyway. A medium-sized storm blew up. People who didn't want to buy the idea that it can be normal for 50 people to burn to death, because that's what happened, shouted for an investigation. And I remember making a note to myself at the time that this was a moment we shouldn't just let go by. It could be one of the worst atrocities of this awful war. But the storm lasted for a week or two, like most of them do. Some good people did great work with satellite pictures and combing through social media chat to piece together a picture of events as best they could. But it became obvious pretty quickly that the UN wasn't going to be allowed into the prison to do an investigation, so the whole thing looked blocked. Until earlier this month, actually, when a woman by the name of Rosemary DiCarlo, the UN's Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs, stood up in front of the Security Council.
Mr. President, the fact-finding mission is set to deploy in the coming days to look into the incident on 29 July that led to the death of 53 Ukrainian prisoners of war. Between 75 and 130 more were injured. I want to thank Ukraine and Russia for their constructive approach in enabling preparations for the mission. We count on their continued support.
So finally, perhaps, there was a chance we'd find out some more. And we tried to jump on it. My colleagues Nina Curiata, Amy Harper and I started getting hold of some of the prisoners' families. We talked to the Red Cross, to the government in Ukraine, to the Russian authorities, the separatists in the east of Ukraine, and most of all to the UN. If they were going in, could we go with them? If not literally, then at least virtually. Could we get in while this gate into the prison seemed at least half open? Into Alenivka. Nina, you're from Ukraine, right? But you're not from this part of it.
Yes, I'm not from Donetsk region.
Which part are you from?
I'm from Odessa region in the south. Okay. And Donetsk region is in the east. And this region is mostly occupied by Russia since 2014.
If I'm looking at a map of Ukraine and looking for Olenivka, where should I be looking?
It's on the right side of Ukrainian map. And Olenivka prison or colony is in Donetsk region, in the district of Volnovakha, in the village of Olenivka, and that is why they call it Olenivka.
When we're talking about Olenivka, we're talking about quite a big place, aren't we? The prison itself.
Yes, it's a huge place. There is like 6 barracks. Every barrack is 2 floors building with a lot of cells for a few people each. It is in the field, surrounded with the wire. It's quite a frightening place even to look at. There are towers in every 100 meters.
And it, from what I've seen, it looks pretty run down.
Yes, it wasn't in use since 2017, and there was literally nothing in the cells, and they've been given only rotted mattresses with bugs and worms in them. And now people came, and the conditions were really, really insane.
What we know for sure about what happened in Olenivka is pretty thin stuff. It probably doesn't amount to much more than this. At about 11 o'clock at night on July the 29th this year, a fierce fire broke out in an old industrial building inside the prison where some prisoners of war were being held. Officially, as I said, 53 prisoners died, but we've got no way of knowing if that's the true figure. There certainly seem to have been a lot of injuries as well. Over the next day or two, pictures of the inside of the building after the fire started to come out. You can see the metal bunks still mostly in neat rows. The first time I looked at them, I didn't spot anything out of the ordinary. It actually took a second or two before I noticed the charred skeletons lying down on a few of the beds. And then there's the walls, just breeze blocks, cinder blocks. They're still standing. And the roof, which is a sheet of corrugated iron, is dangling down in places, but it's mostly still there. And that's about it as far as hard facts go.
Russia has actually blamed Ukraine for this attack.
The Russian Defense Ministry says that the attack was carried out by Ukraine using US-made HIMARS rocket systems.
A spokesman for Moscow-backed separatists said Ukrainian forces attacked after the prisoners of war started talking about crimes conducted by their own military.
So there was an explanation given by the Russians of what happened, but it doesn't feel like a good use of our time to dwell on it for too long. What they said was that the Ukrainians fired a single massively powerful rocket, a HIMARS rocket, which hit that building dead centre and killed all those prisoners, their own soldiers, without knocking the walls down or blowing the roof off. Other people have gone to the trouble of lining up military experts to say that just doesn't make sense. But the truth is, it wouldn't make sense to a 10-year-old. There are plenty of images around what a HIMARS rocket does. It flattens things. It leaves a huge hole in the ground. None of that happened at Olenivka. And then, just a few days after Rosemary DiCarlo said the UN was going into Olenivka to investigate, I was in the middle of interviewing a man called Konstantin Velichko, who we'll hear from in a minute, when Nina WhatsApped me to say it was all off. The UN wasn't getting in after all. We still don't have a very good explanation for what changed. But actually, by then, a different story was already starting to emerge. Not about exactly what happened at Olenivka, but from talking to ex-prisoners and politicians, by looking at what was said in public on private telegram channels, by piecing together events from the siege of Mariupol to the deaths at Olenivka, a story about how the ground can be prepared systematically for an atrocity to take place. How, even if here and now we don't have the facts to say for sure that at least 53 people were murdered at Olenivka and a war crime took place there, everything was done to create the conditions in which both those things could happen, so that a crime became likely, maybe not inevitable, but predictable. I'm Kerry Thomas, and this is A Crime in the Making, a slow newscast from Tortoise. In normal times, it's quite a good road from Mariupol to Olenivka. It's 50 miles or so, and you could drive it in not much more than an hour. When Russia invaded Ukraine, Mariupol was one of the first places it had in its sights. So the siege of Mariupol began effectively on the day of the invasion, February the 24th. And within a week or so, the city was completely surrounded. The horrors started to pile up.
No relief in sight for the city of Mariupol, where more than 100,000 people are still trapped.
It is a city without water, without access to food, without communications, without power. A city reduced to ruins by constant Russian bombardment. A city which cannot even properly bury its dead.
Staying alive in Mariupol has meant descending into basements and bomb shelters at night. then taking your chances outside during the day.
By the 5th of March, the International Red Cross was making more and more desperate pleas for hundreds of thousands of civilians still trapped in Mariupol to be evacuated. And that's where Konstantin comes in.
On the 28th of March, we arrived to the last block post in front of Mariupol.
He's an IT guy, volunteering on a bus plastered with Red Cross logos, going into Mariupol to pull people out. It's a similar journey to ones he's made before, but something changes this time.
Russian militaries asked us to stop our bus and show our documents and started to asking us different, very strange questions. Why we are evacuating people for the money? Why we changing our documents with some military troops and so on, so on and so on. And they even don't want to hear our answers.
So with automatic rifles pointing at him, Konstantin is sent along that short road from Mariupol to Alenivka.
By the way, not just in first impression of Alenivka. On our way to Alenivka, we have very, very many impressions. Then they kicked us, then they used, they told us we are terrorists, then they doesn't give us food, doesn't give us water. But in Alenivka, the most I will remember, I think, all my next life.
Alenivka was a dump.
Almost broken buildings.
Broken toilets, no food, no medicine. None of what many of us would consider the essentials of life.
It was like a shit on the walls.
The prisoners were beaten, tortured regularly.
They beat us by legs, they beat us by arms.
Screams echoed through the buildings.
I was hearing screamings of people.
Konstantin saw one man beaten to death.
I saw one of such cases by my own eyes. They die because they kick them until death.
It's the beginning of April, and Konstantin is lost to the world in this squalid and lawless place. Early April was important to Vladimir Putin, as well as Konstantin. Up around Kyiv, far from Alenivka, the tide started to turn against the Russian invasion. As it went out, it revealed all kinds of horrors.
Images at the weekend from the town of Bucha following the retreat of Russian forces showed the bodies of civilians lying in the streets. Ukrainian human rights officials now say a mass grave near a church may contain as many as 300 bodies.
Even before the war, hardliners in Moscow were demonising Ukrainians as Nazis and worse. But now, with blood on the army's nose around Kyiv and the siege of Mariupol dragging on unforgivably, the language ratcheted up again. A fairly senior politician by the name of Leonid Slutsky, the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Russian Parliament, the Duma, called the defenders of Mariupol animals in human form and said they should be executed, not taken prisoner. The Russian embassy in London put out a tweet saying Azov militants, we'll hear more about them in a minute, deserve execution not by firing squad but by hanging, because they're not real soldiers. They deserve a humiliating death. Twitter took that down eventually because it violated their rules on hate speech, but it was just the tip of the iceberg. By the middle of April, there were just a few pockets of resistance left in Mariupol, and one main one, the giant steelworks at Azovstal.
And the Azovstal steel plant, where Ukrainian military and civilians are holed up by the hundreds, is the site of the last stand there.
Despite being completely outnumbered, they continue to hold out here in one of the largest steel plants in Europe. For now, the soldiers owe their survival to the gigantic network of underground tunnels where they've sheltered for several weeks.
Some regular Ukrainian soldiers were holed up there, but the main fighting force was a notorious unit, the Azov Regiment.
We didn't speak with him, just texting, messaging. I was very careful how to ask about this deathly dangerous things. It was like torture, you know. And I just asked him if they have food or water and ammunition. And he always answered me, yes, yes, everything is good. I never were so close like in this moment of our lives.
On the other end of Alla Samolenko's text messages was her son Ilya, an intelligence officer in the Azov regiment, a giant of a man missing his left hand and his right eye after fighting Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine in 2015.
He explained me something about the regiment.
When he talked to his mother, Ilya painted a very particular picture of the Azov regiment.
Safety of their soldiers. This unit is built under absolutely opposite to ex-USSR army rules and traditions, and trying to incorporate foreign best practices, this possibility to build absolutely new army for Ukraine.
That's not how the rest of the world has seen Azov. Not always, anyway. Back in 2014, a Guardian reporter spent time with Azov and found it riddled with far-right attitudes, even outright Nazi sympathies. So, Nina, the Azov regiment, it's fair to say, isn't it, that it's had problems in the past with extremism?
I would say that it had some connections at the very beginning because it has been founded by a man with a far-right ideology profile, Andriy Beletsky, who founded it in May of 2014. It was one of the volunteer battalions who wanted to defend Ukraine from the Russian invasion in 2014. There were a few of such battalions. This battalion was incorporated into the Ministry of Internal Affairs. It was a special police battalion officially. And Andriy Beletsky was in charge of that battalion for only a few months in 2014. In the autumn, the government incorporated that battalion to the National Guard. The battalion has got a new commander, and they got rid of all people connected with far-right ideology from 2014 till 2017. And it was a smaller battalion at the beginning. There were about 900 people. And during all these 8 years of Russian occupation in the east of Ukraine, there were people who wanted to defend their land. It is the eastern part of Ukraine. There are mostly Russian speakers. There are a lot of Ukrainians, Russians, Jewish and Crimean Tatars in this battalion who coexist normally and they function as one unit. So I wouldn't say it's fair to say now that this is a far-right battalion.
Yeah. So it's founded by a man with these far-right connections. But what does the Ukrainian government say about it now?
It's a regular regiment of the National Guard. It has a number amongst all other regiments in National Guard. So they treat them as any other National Guard regiment. That's it. And in Ukraine, people hugely support Azov and call them heroes because we all seen the siege of Mariupol and their heroic resistance in the Azovstal plant, and probably you remember the Eurovision where the Ukrainian music band claimed from the stage, please free Azov, help Azov, and it was widely supported in Ukraine. Now Ukrainian society supports Azov and calls them heroes because of their resistance.
And you, because you've spent some time thinking about this recently, you're happy that Azov is has got rid of its extremist past, that it is now a regular part of the regular army, and that people are right to think of them as heroes?
Yes, absolutely. And I have to say that even European experts who studied Azov and its history, they say that, yes, they were far-right people, but we cannot call them neo-Nazi. There is a difference.
However much Azov has been reformed, the fact that it was holding out against the Russian siege at the Azovstal steel plant is an important piece of the Alenivka jigsaw. All of those feverish, unfounded Russian allegations that Ukraine was a hotbed of Nazism had found a focus in a regiment which did have an extremist past. If ever Russia were to single out a group of soldiers to murder, these guys would be top of the list.
We were accused as the paramilitary neo-Nazi bandits and all this blah, blah, blah bullshit. But we were the only far-right radicals, yes. But only one thing where we were radical is our primary order is to defend the country.
That's Ilya fronting up for Azov at a press conference on May the 8th, 12 days before the fighters at Azovstal finally surrendered. He talked to his mum over those days, thinking he knew what was coming.
will be just not so tough and not so vulgar and brutal. I don't know what gives them this face, and in a few months they might come back to Ukraine.
So as the end of the siege approached, Alla was calm.
I was quiet. I was sure that everything would be fine before the Olenivka.
Before Olenivka.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Senior business leaders in the UK are keen to harness AI, but there's a complex regulatory maze emerging globally. The OECD, a group of the world's richest countries, which includes the UK, has adopted a new set of principles to ensure that AI operates in a way that's safe, fair, and trustworthy. The principles are wide-ranging, but in essence, call for AI systems to be designed in a way that respects the rule of law and human rights, and says there should be transparency around their use. By embracing the core principles of responsible innovation, UK business leaders can better explore sector-specific opportunities and emerging trends without compromising on citizens' trust. Find out more at ey.ai.
In the days after they surrendered on May the 20th, with Russia able to persuade itself that it had got its hands on some real Nazis, with politicians screaming for them to be executed, the Azov fighters were transported to the dirt and chaos of Olenivka. Konstantin saw them arrive, and he felt a change.
Yeah, the Australian camp was changed. The Russian Federation flag was raised up above the colony, and all personnel of the prison was changed to the Russians. They left only few so-called DPR guards there, and all others was changed to Russian. So atmosphere was changed in a moment.
So up till now, the locals had been in charge at Olenivka, Russian separatists, as they usually call, from what Konstantin mentioned as the DPR, the Donetsk People's Republic. But now the Russians took over, and not just any Russians.
But later, we see very many Russians from FSB, from Russian committee, very many other guys from different Russian organizations, because they was working with prisoners of war.
Konstantin says the FSB, or the FSB as we'd pronounce it, was running the show now. Not regular prison guards, but the direct descendants of the KGB. You can feel another piece of the jigsaw at Olenivka clicking into place. When the Azov fighters at the steelworks agreed to surrender, Russia gave guarantees they wouldn't be mistreated or tortured. For a short while, those guarantees may have held. And when you hear Konstantin talk about the isolator, he's talking about prisoners in solitary confinement being tortured.
Russia promised that prisoners of war arrived from Azovstal will not be tortured. And it was true for the first few weeks. But later they find a way, as usual, so they was tortured but hidden. If before this moment they tortured prisoners of war on an open air and anyone can see this, with Azov, They find another strategy. They just take them to the isolator, to the camera, to the room for one man, make very loud music, and kick them so nobody, almost nobody, can see this and hear this.
And Konstantin noticed something else that I found fascinating and important.
They was very scary about Azov. They was thinking they are like supermans. They was thinking they. I can tell you that then they asked one or two guys from Azov to get to the question. For questioning, they take at least 10 Russian Spetsnaz special soldiers who was guarding these two guys to the room for questioning. It was very scary of Azov Stars.
So according to Konstantin, the Russian guards were terrified of the Azov fighters. Even Spetsnaz soldiers, guys from elite units, made sure they outnumbered Azov prisoners heavily when they took them for questioning.
It's how the government tell them. It's a very bad Nazis who just want to kill Russians, who are using drugs and many other things. They was just hearing and even don't think if it's true or not. So they was scared of them. They was thinking that that guys can just take arms and starting to kill them. But it's not true. It's the same guys as me and all others. I don't know why they're so scared.
If you're intent on committing a war crime against a group of people, history shows it's a precondition to dehumanize them. The Nazis used to paint their victims as subhuman. Konstantin saw the Russians treating Azov fighters as if they were superhuman. But oddly, I think the effect is the same. Not human. Another piece of the jigsaw falls into place. All of this, Konstantin saw before he was suddenly released from Malenivka on July the 4th and made his way slowly to Germany where I talked to him. What happened after he left is sketchy. We've tried every route we can think of to track down someone who's been released since then, but we've drawn a blank. It seems most likely that nobody has been let out, certainly no one who could give an account of what happened on July the 29th. There have clearly been some messages sneaked out from Malenivka to the outside world through the Telegram app. We haven't been able to verify them, but what they say is that in late July, prisoners were put to work converting an abandoned building on the industrial side of the prison that Nina mentioned, about 300 or 400 metres from where prisoners were normally kept. It was unusual because it had never happened before, and there didn't seem to be any need for it. As the end of July approached, about 200 members of the Azov regiment, and apparently only Azov soldiers, were moved to the new barracks. Around the same time, satellite images began to show what appeared to be some large holes being dug in the earth inside the prison fence. Nobody can say what for. And that's how things stood as darkness fell on July the 29th. Until 11 o'clock, when the prisoners in the regular barracks heard what's been described to us as an explosion, and dozens upon dozens of prisoners of war died in the flames. Who lit the match or primed the bomb that killed them, we don't know. But look at everything that was said and done in the space of not much more than 2 months, from the siege of Mariupol to the fire at Olenivka. The men who died were demonised, dehumanised, sent to a brutal camp run by security police and set apart where nobody could see what would happen to them. At the end of all that, when you hear that they died, it doesn't sound surprising. It sounds obvious.
My name is Yevgeny Popov, E-V-G-E-N-Y, P-O-P-O-V. And I'm MP, member of parliament, and I'm a journalist. I'm an anchor on the Russian state TV for many years, more than 20 years.
I booked a call with one of President Putin's highest profile public backers. And so one of the things I want to talk to you about is the use of language in this conflict and where you draw a line and where others have drawn a line
and whether language is important in a war like this, because what it permits if the language is extreme, I suppose.
You just told me about the language of war, right? And it's important. It's really important.
My understanding is that you personally justify and explain the invasion of Ukraine because you see Russians and Ukrainians as effectively one people. Is that right?
Of course it's one people, because my own father lives in Ukraine right now in a territory which is under Kyiv's control right now. And of course, if you hear people in Russia, some officials, some authorities called Azov battalion as an animals, it's close to truth, I can say you. Because even if you read U.S. law, U.S. Congress have recognized Azov battalion around 7 years ago as a neo-Nazi organization. Neo-Nazi. They are fascists, really Nazis. And of course, we're not going to talk with them.
Let me just jump in there for a moment, because of course, many years ago, 7-8 years ago, I think the Azov battalion, the Azov regiment, did have problems with extremists, with neo-Nazis. But the Ukrainian government now says that it's reformed, that it was a militia, it was volunteered, it's now been brought into the regular army, and those problems have been addressed. And what you're talking about is the history of Azov, where it came from, and not what it's like now.
It's completely lie, because it was official militia, official. It wasn't volunteers. It was a battalion, but it was Azov battalion was the part of the interior ministry for many, many years. And you can see Nazi symbols on their arms right now. You can see and hear Nazi slogans right now from them. And of course, people who wants to divide my country for many parts, fascists and Nazis, and they've been Nazi, they are still Nazi. There are many Nazis in the Ukrainian army right now.
You said some of the Azov members, you were happy to describe them as nearly animals. But I guess what interests me is if you are happy to describe, and your colleagues are happy to describe, members of the Azov regiment, for example, as animals, then to me, it makes war crimes more likely, because you don't think you're dealing with human beings, you're dealing with animals, and you treat them differently.
It's an emotion when I call them near animals. Of course, they are people, but they're war criminals. They must be punished for their war crimes. That's it.
And if you, I hate what you say about emotion, but if you were in Olenivka, if you had been a guard looking after the members of the Azov regiment who were there, and you hear people in Moscow, members of the Duma, describing Azov as animals, that must affect the way you treat those people.
I just told you that I want to see a process. And I know a lot about what happened in Olenivka on July 29th, right? It was a crime from Ukrainian army. It was a shelling from Ukrainian side by US-made missiles, which is called HIMARS. I didn't know why they did it, because they have killed their own people. But I'm not impressed.
Let me come back to what you said about Olenivka, because you've been a correspondent in war zones. You know what war looks like. You know what weapons can do. The only images that I have seen of Alenivka are those that the Russian authorities have released. So I've seen only what.
But you can go to Russian to do a film about it.
Yeah,
you can.
But I can,
if you want.
What the images show is a building that is, all the walls are still standing, where the beds inside are still arranged in neat rows. And yet the explanation is that a hugely powerful missile, which blows buildings to pieces, landed and killed these people. And it's an explanation that doesn't make any sense, does it?
I am not a military expert. I'm a journalist and I'm a politician. And I can say you that we are invited any international organization to inspect what happened in Alenivka.
Well, the UN still hasn't been allowed in.
No, it's not true. We are awaiting UN inspectors, but they can't go. I don't know why. We are allowed them to go. Okay, let's go. Come here and investigate it. And we will give you everything. We will give you a freedom of moving around Alenivka prison camp, everything you want, because we know the truth. We don't need to kill prisoners of war. I don't know what can be the reason to kill them.
Well, because you think they're animals.
You know, they are war criminals. And why we didn't do it earlier? We need them alive because they should be punished by law, by court, not by American-made missile.
I didn't expect to agree with Yevgeny Popov, but at least we agreed on something. We agreed that language matters. A scientist will tell you that an intense fire can create a vacuum. And that's what's happened at Alenivka. No sound has escaped from there, no hard information, since July the 29th. There's still no official list of any kind of who was killed in the fire or who was injured. Under the Geneva Convention, Russia's duty-bound to produce one. And yes, they are still signatories. Allah and all the other relatives of the soldiers who were there are left feeding off scraps, guessing. She thinks Ilya is still alive.
Just rumours and only one connection with volunteers who were freed from Alenivka on 4th of July. And I've sent Ilya's photo and they answered me that they've seen him there in Alenivka. And Ilya was moved from Alenivka to unknown place in the middle of June.
In the end, whether the UN gets in or not, the truth about Alenivka will come out. Enough people survive that it can't be buried forever. Alenivka may, I think will, take its place alongside other atrocities on the list of war crimes committed in Europe in the last few decades. We thought that list had been closed forever in 1945. And then, just 3 or 4 hours, literally before this podcast was going to be released, there was a twist in the story. So this is an update. Nina, the news came to you quite late last night. What did you hear at first?
First of all, I saw a lot of happy posts on Facebook from my journalists and editors' friends who just couldn't believe that it might happen, that 215 Ukrainian prisoners of war, including 108 Azov members, have been exchanged for 55 Russian prisoners of war. And the most pro-Russian Ukrainian politician, Viktor Medvedchuk, a big friend of Vladimir Putin, who was accused in the state treason in Ukraine.
And in amongst those 215 prisoners of war who released was?
There was Ilya Samoylenko, but there was no information about him on my Facebook so far. And I immediately texted Alla because I wasn't sure if he was in or not, because Alla was worried that in the previous exchanges he wasn't on the list. And I just texted her and said, Alla, what about Ilya? And she said, yes, Ilya is exchanged as well. And it was such a relief. But Alla still, she's in the US now together with two wives of Azov commanders, and one of them, Denis Prokopenko, has been exchanged and moved to Turkey, and the other one was not. And all of three of them say that, yes, we are glad for those who've been exchanged now and earlier, but we have to remember that there were 2,000 people and most of them are still imprisoned.
And Alla is sure, is she, that he's out?
Yes, she is sure, and he let her know that he is going home, and she posted in the morning that she is quite exhausted but happy, and she has a big hope that they will meet at home soon.
One of the things we've been waiting for, of course, is for prisoners who were held at Olenivka on July the 29th to be released so that we can get a fuller picture of what happened there on that night. Do you know if any of the 215 people who came out yesterday were at Olenivka in late July?
I know that Mariana Mamonova, a pregnant Ukrainian doctor, was in Olenivka in this special isolator called Prison in Prison. But all people whom we talked to during, like, when we made this podcast, they were released from Olenivka before the 29th of July. So we cannot know for sure, but we still can try to talk to them. But we have to remember that these people are quite exhausted and stressed, and maybe the press access would be limited somehow. This Slow Newscast was written and presented by Kerry Thomas. The reporter was me, Nina Kuryata. The producer was Amy Harper. Sound design was by Tom Burchill.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. The risks posed by AI range from bias in decision-making to misinformation and the misuse of personal information, all at an unprecedented scale. Nearly a quarter of UK businesses understand that the regulatory landscape is changing fast, and nearly half are tracking new regulatory guidance to be responsive to emerging best practice. The EY Responsible AI Service helps organisations innovate safely, providing confidence that AI and generative AI technologies are developed and managed ethically, transparently, and sustainably, and that potential regulatory and reputational risks are identified and mitigated. Discover how you can create a better working world with AI by going to ey.ai.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That's a sort of freedom, like an intrinsic knowledge, like you are part ocean, ocean is part you. You have salt water in your body. You are part of this.
Oceans, life underwater. A new podcast all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them.
Subscribe now to Oceans, Life Underwater on your favorite podcast app.